Mining Web Weekly, Peter Major, Modern Corporate Solutions. This week we are talking about things that could go well for South Africa. Let's hope. Peter, as always, we like to look on the bright side. And so if there's any good news that comes on for South Africa, I'm all ears. And today in the FT News Briefing, which is a huge podcast that goes all around the world and is very well consumed, one of the biggest in the world, there was a piece talking about the European Union putting together a critical mineral operation, and that the first country that they visited to try and get a deal was South Africa. So now let's just go back. Why would they be doing this? And what is motivating them to take this somewhat unusual step?
Well, Alec, for the last 100 years, if you were looking at acquiring minerals, your knee-jerk reaction was South Africa, because we've got virtually every mineral known to man here, and we are producing the majority of them. So there's a lot we have that we're not producing, but we can't explain quite how it worked that God, nature, Allah, put so many minerals in this one country. The theory is when you shake Africa, all of Africa is mineral rich, but we all know with gravity, you keep shaking, most of it goes to the bottom. And that's as logical an explanation as I can come up with. But yeah, this is one-stop shopping. For anybody that wants to acquire minerals, your first tick should be South Africa. And then we always tell people we're non-aligned. And we should be using that to our advantage, not negatively. Yeah, we should be non-aligned. We should be able to deal with anybody, any of the 210 countries on the planet, as long as they tick our conditions, our terms and conditions. So yeah, it's a very logical, well-based decision. Start talking with us first.
But what is this critical minerals entity that the European Union is putting together, and why?
Look, it's a little bit of wishful thinking. When I first read that, Alec, my brain jumped to the United States in World War II, because now you've got, these were real world wars, and you were fighting two fronts in America. And they realized real quickly what minerals, what metals you needed. You needed chrome, you needed diamonds, you know, for cutting tools. You needed aluminum and copper like you couldn't believe. So all of a sudden, anybody in America that was living here at that time, remember, you had to turn in your aluminum, copper pots and pans. You had to go to cast iron and maybe even steel, because it was for the war effort. Well, economics is just war practiced in a different means. And hell, the war that's going on now economically, you know, Russia, China, America. So I saw some of those European comments. They said America's out there grabbing minerals right under our noses. Well, yeah, because it's a war. So Trump says, I don't want to be dependent on anybody. I want to have enough minerals and metals that we can sustain our economy, no problem. So Europe better get a move on. And it's harder united 28, 29 countries than it is America. You know, so my first question would have been, okay, but who's going to coordinate this in Europe, and who's going to foot the bill? Are countries going to buy these minerals and then sell them to the businesses? Or are they going to tell business, hey, we'll do centralized buying for you, but you got to kick in. You're the guys that need this. So it can get complex. We don't really care in South Africa, do we? We just want to sell as many minerals at the best price as possible. So we don't really care where the European money comes from. But I would say we are open for business big time. And don't just put up a sign, but open the door and grease the rollers. You know, dangle some candy and some lingerie. You know, let's really attract the people. Let's get them trying to buy everything from us.
But why now?
Well, what triggered it was the United States / Donald Trump putting tariffs on Chinese goods, and China retaliating by limiting the supply of rare earths and other critical components. And that's what's woken us up. You know, right now, China can just hold off on rare earths to really shake us up. But what if they started holding back on copper? You know, they're smelting more than half the world's copper. We don't have the smelter capacity in America to even smelt our own copper. So what if they start holding off on other minerals? So I would say that's the match that lit the fuse, was the trade war that the United States has ignited with China, and China retaliating, limiting rare earths. And as Europe said, we're collateral damage. We didn't have anything to do with Mr. Trump fighting with China, but now China limits rare earths, and gee, our auto manufacturers and our other critical users of that mineral, we can't get it. So yeah, we've been beaten up just as bad as the United States, and we had nothing to do with this.
Okay, so the Chinese are now saying we will not provide to the rest of the world or those that we don't like. And the Americans have already made a plan, Donald Trump's at it, and the European Union has belatedly woken up and said, whoa, hang on, if China's not going to be providing these minerals, we better make a plan for ourselves. And hence the or reaching out to South Africa.
Yeah, look, I'm imagining if I was in Europe and I was helping run this show, I would be doubling my efforts to negotiate with China and say, please don't include us in your sanctions of America. You know, so you always have a diplomatic front, even in war, right? You still have your diplomats negotiating, but well, your generals are busy fighting and your economy's busy making plans. And China's, they're not stupid. They saw what happened when the Arabs tried to restrict oil supply to America in the early 70s. And that triggered the crazy increase in oil prices. But you can't drink all that oil. You got to sell it to somebody, right? And so you can imagine how long that Arab oil embargo really would have worked in America. Not that long, because they needed the money. And so China, they're not going to just stop selling rare earths overnight, but all of a sudden they limit it to certain customers. All of a sudden they kind of increase the price, maybe magnitudes. You know, if the U.S. needs it so bad, why don't we sell it to them at double the price or triple the price? Because we see they're very happy to pay triple the price, starting an operation in Brazil or Australia and fast-tracking it. So there's a lot of money to be made here by players doing the right things.
And what about the richest rare earth deposit on Earth that's sitting in the northern, well, the Western Cape, in the northern part of the Western Cape, called Steenkampskraal, that we have looked into and discussed at some length? It's sitting there. It's got the deposits. They've got a small mine now that is going to come into production next year. If you were advising the CEO and the shareholders of that company, surely this is an opportunity of a lifetime for them.
It is that exactly, Ali. Opportunity of a lifetime. They're in a good position. It's how you play your cards. And I've had small discussions with the gentleman running Steenkampskraal since you and I last spoke. And they did open my eyes to a few things that they said, Peter, the radiation is much lower underground, and we're going to be rotating them in, and we've got approval from the radiation authority, you know, the South African nuclear regulatory body. So that is not a limit. It's not like we got a problem finding men to work. It's not like we got a problem radiating them. You know, they said it's very, very low doses, much lower than anybody's going to get working at Cooper. So that's great if they can do that. The other effects, they say, because they're going to remove the thorium and radioactive component of rare earths, they can transport their concentrate anywhere they want without any kind of special authority permitting. That is a huge breakthrough that I didn't know about. If they can really do that, if they can subtract the radioactive component on the mine, boy, there's really not much stopping them. And then they went on about some of the commercial aspects that, yes, the IDC is a very willing, able partner, but they're a small partner overall. And the best part is they said the IDC is not limiting who they talk to, what kind of deals they want to structure with the parties. So if those three components are as true as they say they are, very, very exciting. It means they've got the latitude to go left, right, up, down, deal with whoever they want. yeah, they got to take advantage of it though now. And I don't know who all they're talking to. I know some Chinese companies are very interested because China knows rare earths. I know South Africa is very interested in upscaling the product rather than just selling rock. And we know the rock is radioactive, so it does have to be concentrated and refined to a certain degree to remove that radioactive component. And as always, how does an average investor get involved? Well, the average investor can't get involved here because it's not listed. They were listed 30 some years ago, and investors couldn't wait 30 years for the price to go up. But they're not listed now, but private equity has a lot of opportunity here, and off-takers have huge opportunity. So I would think they'd be even better shape than the Orion team. You know, Orion's got lots of off-takers interested in their copper and their zinc, but geez, you've got powerful players out there interested in rare earths.
Fascinating story and a very good one for South Africa, but the key part, as you mentioned, is we've got to play our cards right. It looks like Mark Bristow didn't play his cards right at Barrick with the emergence there of Elliott, the activist investor, now being disclosed or being exposed as a big player on Barrick. It wants to unlock shareholder value. Do you think there might have been something with the Elliott guys getting involved that led to the rapid departure, surprise departure of the South African CEO of that company?
Good question, Alec. I would say there's a 50-50 chance. I don't think Elliott was the only shareholder in Barrick that was displeased with the price. And I'm not sure if Elliott had many shares in Barrick until very recently. You know, I read the announcement, ooh, Elliott, the most fearsome activist fund in Wall Street, has now taken up or admits they have $700 million of Barrick shares. Well, yeah, $700 million is a lot of money for Alec Hogg and Peter Major. But if Barrick's market cap is $64 billion, that is 1.1%. So is that a big stake? You know, and not only is that not a big stake in Barrick, 1.1, I think Elliott's assets under management are probably $75 billion. So it's not a big stake for them. Like 1% of their total fund is in Barrick. But if they do punch above their weight and they've got people following them, they can affect things like CEO appointments or splitting the company. And I can see why they want to split it, because it's hard to grow ounces when you're that large. Now, Newmont's pushing 6 million ounces. Barrick, at most, is pushing 3.5 million. But even that is a lot of ounces to grow on. And that's why the share prices of those two big companies have really been lagging the gold indices, the other shares, because they're pretty much ex-growth. So you could win two ways by splitting Barrick's assets. You could say investors are not happy having companies in Mali, the DRC, and now you want to put us in Pakistan with a $9 billion investment that's probably going to take 5 years to start generating cash. And, you know, Pakistan's not that far from Taliban land, right? They've even got Taliban inside Pakistan. So, heck, I don't think Elliott are the only people saying maybe some of these areas are too risky for us. And America's got great legislation. They got administration that is pushing mining like we haven't seen in 100 years. Nevada, we could start at one end of the state and mine it all the way to the other end. Yeah, maybe it does make sense. And let's get our PE rating up. You know, if the average mining share PE is 20 and yours is 18, and you're gold, you're supposed to be another 50% higher. So yeah, Elliott could have an effect, but I'll bet there's other parties saying the same thing.
Because from what the commentators have been saying and the reports are that Barrick has now taken one bloody nose too many with the junta in Mali going in and taking over their second richest mine. So now get rid of all these nonsense, exit that area and focus just on North America, where at least we know there isn't a government that is going to come and nationalize the operation on the grounds that its members of the junta need a little bit of extra cash.
Yeah, that's exactly the balance, Alec. Assets, gold assets in America are going to cost you a lot more than they would in Africa. And they're probably, on the whole, not going to be as high a grade, might not even be as long a life, but you got a stable political, economic, logistical environment. And we all know, I'm a mining engineer. I always get sucked into the deposit, you know, and I become oblivious to what surrounds the deposit. Africa's got fantastic deposits. But geez, DRC was holding back dividends for Randgold and AngloGold for years at Kibali. And that is the most modern, beautiful underground gold mine on the planet. Mark Bristow should be famous forever just for that mine. And here it was generating cash, and the DRC said, well, we need the cash, and they held on. I think they finally paid everything they held, but that's the risk you run. Great deposits seem to be in difficult countries that are unpredictable, unreliable.
So the opportunity for South Africa has to be massive. If you can consider the governance, well, you've got a constitutional democracy rather than a place that's run by a few guys who got big guns. It must be, if you can get your governance right, it must be just the most beautiful dripping roast for a gold mining industry where there's a heck of a lot of gold, you tell us, still in the ground.
Oh, without a doubt. Just think of that $9 billion that Barrick wants to spend in Pakistan. Can you imagine if you brought that $9 billion to South Africa? You know, you could have funded at least 4 deep-level gold mines that would all produce 500,000 ounces a year easy. You know, Western Areas at one time was producing 700,000 ounces out of that one Ellsberg shaft in Val Rees. You know, Harmony Gold Mine, the lowest grade gold mine in South Africa when I came here in 82, but they were doing 1 million ounces a year. So yeah, bang for buck. You get the best value here if we just had a more stable, accommodating leadership and government.
But we seem to be doing a lot better on a lot of other areas. It would be a concern to the rational thinker that mining somehow is still stuck in some kind of a morass that it won't get out of. And you make a good point there. Why are they going to Pakistan, for heaven's sake, of all places? It's known to be highly turbulent and very fragile, when South Africa it's in a much better location, and it hasn't had anything like the risk issues you'd think that a Pakistan would have.
Look, that's a huge deposit, and the majority of it for a long time is going to be open pit. And unfortunately, the way the industry has gone all over the world is governments, regulators, do-gooders have almost forced mining into doing open pit, which is much more destructive, much more capital intensive, employs much fewer people, but they say it's for safety. We are not willing to risk the life of one man underground. So we'll import these giant multi-million dollar machines and we'll burn more diesel, but we're not going to risk a man underground who could be killed because he wasn't trained right, or he was doing something dumb, or in a lot of cases, he was doing something illegal. And I've seen it here in America, Alec, and you see it in New Zealand, Australia, ore deposits, you know, 2-3 feet wide, that should be mined with traditional methods and would be much more profitable. And yet investors say, no, you put down big equipment. We don't care if it dilutes the grade. We don't care if it raises the cost. We don't care if it destroys a lot more of the environment. We're not going to fund it otherwise because we have to follow these ESG, mine safety, health regulations, blah, blah, blah.
What a story. Anyway, so that's Barrick. Would you be buying Barrick shares on the promise of a return to at least a similar rating to other gold mining companies, if not superior?
No, not now. And not because of Barrick, because of just my view on the gold price, Alec. It's $4,100. I think it's peaked. You know, it comes down to below 4,000, then it shoots up to 42, but it doesn't stay there a nanosecond. I think it's oscillating at a very high level. And that would be the reason. But the story, yes, I would buy Barrick. If I heard this story a year ago, I would have been buying Barrick for that reason. And if it falls, all gold shares are going to fall. and it hasn't run as high as the others. And I believe that would bring about a re-rating. You have to hope that the American part that rates higher cancels out how much the non-America part falls. And I got to believe Mali can be resolved. But see, it's a new government that are desperados. If it's a government that's been in place for a bit, they will eventually see logic and rationality. But, you know, with a military junta, they're living day at a time. They know they could be killed. They could be thrown out. They could be reelected. But they have to get the message. What you guys are doing is not helping the country. You're deterring future and further investment. But yeah, it's unpredictable what these countries do because their leaders are so unpredictable. And unfortunately, most of these leaders are selfish.
Well, selfishness is also something that has been leveled at Eskom. We weren't saying that when there wasn't power in South Africa, when we had lockouts and, well, blackouts. Now we have Merafe and its joint venture with Glencore today announcing that, sorry, we've tried to negotiate with government. We've spent 3 months trying to get a decent electricity price, but you simply cannot run a ferromanganese smelter if you don't have cheaper electricity. And so they're pulling the plug on essentially a something that's been there for a long time and where South Africa has at least for decades been a world leader. But ferrochrome is now, it's not done, isn't it, in South Africa just about because of the high price of Eskom? Or is there some upside?
There's possible upside, but I don't think this government is capable of it, Alec, because what made this country so competitive was a very focused, driven government that focused on commerciality, that focused on longevity, that was willing to bite the bullet, eat dog food, sleep in the car, and have a national consensus. This is what needs to be done to put in first-class world infrastructure. And they did that hand in hand with industry. And I think the people keep forgetting that the Afrikaners and the English were not best friends the last 120 years. In fact, they were actually dreaded enemies after that Boer War. And yet they saw the need to work together, business and government and the population. And they put in an infrastructure that you can't put in overnight. And you put in the systems and the institutions to run that and keep it worldly competitive. That was our benchmark. Everything done in South Africa the last, say, from 1900, certainly until 2000, everything had to be benchmarked against world class. Now, we know it's been pretty much destroyed. And can it be fixed? Yes, but it can only be fixed if you change current leadership's thinking, if you change current leadership's actions. And I'm sure the current government wants to save those jobs, but they don't know how. You know, they're juggling too many things. They have too many priorities, you know, whether it's feeding the cadres or feeding yourself and your cronies or your family. And there's probably a few in government that actually do care about the long-term survival of South Africa. But it's all these competing interests that aren't focused. And our legislation shows that. Just our mining legislation, which I can't keep up with. There's too many rules and regulations. They're trying to do too much. And if we could vaporize everybody's memory in government and just implant a couple new ideas saying, people, your job here is to create jobs. Your job is to make the most attractive investment environment on the planet. That will attract lots of money, create lots of jobs, and make this a rich country. And see, if they had a clean head and hadn't thought about all the opportunities they're missing out or could take because of their positions of power, they could do that. So, yeah, let's get back to Glencore. Sure, a big cut in electricity will help them. It might keep them alive another year or two and buy enough time for government to fix the water, the highways, the railroads, the ports, to put a clamp down on criminal mining. But it would be temporary, but it's a great start. But Eskom's not in that strong a position, and they got such erratic policies now because they've been gutted for decades. But it's never too late to try. And we got to preserve the furnaces we've got because they do add a lot of value. They employ a lot of people, and those are quality jobs. Those are good jobs. And as we all know, there's a nearly an 8 or 10 to 1 multiplier effect that if you've got an actual worker on a mine, there's probably 8 workers that are in industries helping that mine. You know, it's an ecosystem. So government can't do enough, and they should try to look back and say, can we undo some of this convoluted legislation we've got? Can we simplify it? But they got to lower the cost of Eskom. You got to get all corruption out of Eskom. You got to get all favoritism and convoluted hiring policies, buying policies, and you got to make it commercially world-class like it once was.
It's an interesting point, though, that the government was asked to step in here and has not done so. Now, I'm not sure if that's because it cannot or that it doesn't want to, but we have a similar situation with ArcelorMittal with the steel plant in Newcastle. And it was almost like at the back of people's minds, they thought, well, the ANC is never going to let that plant close. There are far too many people whose livelihoods would be affected. And the MK party, their big threat is very strong in that part of the country. So if they let ArcelorMittal go and all those thousands of people fall on hard times, well, they would then start voting for the opposition and it could have political implications. So it's almost like a thought in the back of minds that, well, the IDC will be forced eventually to buy ArcelorMittal. It hasn't happened. And that deal's now finished. So can anybody come in, or what happens next?
First of all, you can't keep forcing government entities to do commercially unviable transactions. They've been doing that for the last 30 years, and that's why we're in the state we're in. You know, their biggest transaction was government forcing their peristatals to fund, what did we say? 1 trillion rand has funded 100 chosen cadres. Has that generated any jobs? Has it generated anything sustainable? So, no, government can't keep funding that via the IDC, the Business Development Corp, the PIC, because they're just stripping those companies by doing it. They've got to correct their policy. And I've been to some of the government meetings, and they do come across as wanting to help. But, Alec, it is so convoluted. When you got, what's on the board of Eskom? 21 people, 22 people, you know, the IDC, how many's on the board? 22 people. Can you imagine Oppenheimer trying to run Anglo-American with more than 6 or 8 people on the board? You know, that's hard to manage. You know, a handful and a half is hard to manage. So it's paralysis. All these problems that we come up with, they're being studied by groups, but then you got huge numbers of people that are on the decision-making side. And it's paralysis. It's too slow. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is. And we see the consequences of almost every government decision and policy. It's called the law of unintended consequences. Because everything is complicated and interlinked, and they often haven't worked through, what is the consequence of us making this decision? Well, to save Lion Furnace, that consequence is pretty immediate. You know, you're going to save some jobs and keep some foreign exchange coming. But where are you taking the money from? Have you changed policy to help them? Have you given them a bank loan? Is someone going to take a 10% cut? Does Lionor get to spend the money the way they want? Man, it shows instead of trying to cater to all these individual exceptions, just like we had before, a great policy that all businesses benefit from, and they can plan things and do it themselves. That's what happens with a centralized government. It's trying to do too much, and it's a car wreck, a train wreck.
Mm. A level playing field. But when you have a lobby economy, as it's been described in quite a lot of detail, a lobby economy, the one who lobbies the hardest, and when you have people in positions of power who are not squeaky clean, well, the one who lobbies the hardest is not always the one who deserves what comes through to them. And indeed, 100%. They're not always the most honest of it. But let's just have a look as we close today on gold. You did mention earlier, Peter, that you think the gold price has peaked. Why?
Well, I base it relative to other investment opportunities, Alec. And I base it relative to other asset values. So I read the Economist article, and they explored the different reasons gold has gone up or it could be going up. You know, central bank buying, individuals buying, people afraid of inflation from the states. They're afraid of devaluation of the dollar. They're afraid of a trade war that escalates into something short of a world war. And then they tried to explore those reasons in that Economist article. And the first myth they kind of debunked was central bank buying. They said their information is central bank buying is no higher than it was a year ago. So they don't think that's what's pushing it. They went through a couple other possibilities, and it ended up it's the ETFs and it's the hot money. That's what's really swinging it. But we know hot money moves down as fast as it moves up. It moves out as quick as it moves in. And so they were monitoring the growth in ETFs. And they said, yes, there's ETF holdings of about 620 tons of gold. That's what South Africa produced for decades, 620 tons a year. That's a large amount. And they say that is fickle. And they don't know who's holding the ETFs. What's the percentage of small investors? What's the percentage of, say, pension funds, you know, long-term stable holders? What's the percentage of hedge funds, activist funds, private equity? But that's what's now driving it either way. And I just look at where is gold compared to where it was a year ago? And I say, where are the other available asset categories like property, like bonds, cash? And you pointed out a couple interviews ago, yeah, and where's oil? Hey, when have we seen oil down here at $59, $60? Very, very long time ago. And yet here's gold at $4,000. You were talking about not a bad time to switch. Well, gee, Alec, I think Sasol's up about 30% relative to gold since then. So yes, there's a lot of assets that have fallen or haven't moved, and maybe they're safer to be in right now. Because if gold keeps going up, it's going to drag a lot of other asset values with it. So why not be in them instead?
Peter Major is with Modern Corporate Solutions and bringing to a close this week's Mining Web Weekly. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.